She made me cry again just talking about it. Hi, I'm George. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really grateful to be here and to be sober. Thank you, Steve, for inviting me. Thank you to the committee for this incredible convention. This has just been magnificent. I am overpaid in Alcoholics Anonymous. And let's see. I want to thank the speakers. You've all been wonderful. Some I haven't heard, some I have heard before. Terry, I am absolutely positive you were here for my friend Nancy, who I want to thank for coming with me. After Terry spoke yesterday, Nancy was gone, and I thought she may have been in the powder room. And I went back up to our room, and I found her on the bed with Kleenex just all around her, just sobbing. It was beautiful. And that's what we do for each other. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous thinking that if you really knew who I was, if you knew these things about me, you wouldn't love me. And then I find out as I get sober that it's in telling those things that I swore I'd never tell another human being that gets rid of the separateness that I feel between me and you and actually sets me free. And I am free in every area of my life today as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of the Joe, the two Joes, Joe C, you were my favorite. Joe Conroy, actually, I've been friends with for many years, a couple of decades, actually. And if you're thinking I look familiar, it may be because if you were at the karaoke session, yes, that was Joe and I, doing a little Sonny and Cher, and we've been at our autograph kiosk, and we're sure that you're all going to be there any moment. So far, we haven't had a lot of people coming by, but we're going to keep on singing. Anyway, I feel like there's other people I should be thanking, but I am super self-obsessed in this moment right now because I'm a little bit nervous. I still get nervous every time I talk, which I think is a good thing. Oh, I know, Heather. Thank you for coming all the way from Knoxville, which many people say is about a four-hour drive. Heather told me it's 2 hours. So I'm sure that I would drink with Heather. And my friends Mary Beth and Jimmy, I love you guys. Great to see you. And Lee, of course, love you, man. Okay, now all about me. I've been sober since February 1st, 1993. I got sober when I was 24. And I just turned 24 years sober and turned 49 in May, and I never dreamed I would be this old. Now, I realize that there may be some older people here in the audience today, but this is the oldest I've ever been, and it is shocking. There is some stuff happening. I started drinking really young, so I just never dreamed I would be this age. I don't remember when I had my first drink. I feel like alcohol was always a part of my life. I have pictures going back as early as 11 months old of me drinking out of my dad's beer stein. So I think, well, maybe that was my first drink. I don't remember that first drink. I feel like I tapered on. And but I was arrested for drinking in public when I was 11, so I know it was a problem by then. And my dad died of cancer when I was 6, and I was left with a single mom, and she worked 3 jobs to take care of me and to, you know, to take care of us, my mom and I. And she was very angry, very tired all the time, very depressed, and sort of threw her hands up where I was concerned. She said, you know what, you're going to do whatever you're going to do anyway, and I'd rather you do it at home if you're going to do it. And so at an early age, I was smoking. At 10 years old, I was smoking Marlboro Red Box. I just can't even imagine that. Back then, cigarettes were 55 cents, and I would go to the Mohawk gas station and buy them. And I was stealing my mom's Buick Wildcat at 10 years old, cruising it around the neighborhood. I was the kid in the neighborhood you didn't want your kids hanging out with. Our house was the house in the neighborhood with the overgrown yard. Stopping for a moment. My wonderful host, of course that's who I was forgetting, Lisa. You have been the most gracious, lovely host ever. A+, A+. And my co-host, Chad, thank you, who is Joe's host. Okay, now back to me. I knew there was something. So smoking and drinking, really young. My mom throws up her hands. So at a really young age, I don't know where I got this idea, or I really couldn't articulate it at the time, but I had this sense that if somebody loved me, I'd be okay. And so that's what I saw. And my first higher power was your approval. I needed it like I needed oxygen. I needed your approval. And I hated myself. And I thought that that was not self-obsession. I thought you were self-obsessed if you thought you were great. But if you thought you were a piece of crap, that wasn't. And so I had constant thought of how much I hated myself. And I started hanging out with the older kids in the neighborhood and partying with them, and they were more accepting of me. And I feel like from the youngest age, I had these really big emotions. I feel like I was born singing the blues. Like, everything was such a big deal, and I was so impacted by the simplest things. But in school, I was about the height I am now. And that's 5'7". So kids develop a whole lot later than that normally. And so the kids in school came up with a nickname for me, which was BFU, and it stood for Big, Fat, and Ugly. And so that was not what I was striving for. And that, when I was looking for your approval, that's not what I was hoping for. And, you know, it's so hard to shake those old ideas, too. Last year I went to my 30-year high school reunion. Still can't believe I'm this old. But anyway, so, and I thought, you know what? I'm sober now. I have a really good life. I can go to this reunion. I can have a good time. I did not fit in school, just so you know. Like, I was the kid who was dropping out of school. I was the kid who was in detention, in Saturday detention. I was the 13-year-old who was pregnant and left school for a while. I was that kid. I did not fit in, but I have this idea that I'm going to go to my 30-year reunion and feel good. And so I talked my best friend Diana into going, and she was a popular, cool kid, and she didn't want to go, and so we went, and the Friday night activities weren't so bad, but I kind of expected the girls to look like me. They didn't. They were all super skinny, perfect hair, perfect makeup, wearing high heel shoes, the kind I can only wear laying down, if you know what I mean, and they are perfect, and I'm thinking, how did this happen? And so I start feeling really small, but I go to the Saturday event, and I'm like, trying to reach out to people but not fitting in. And at one point, a couple of the girls started doing some of the cheers. And that's when I was just like, this is too much. I cannot bear this. And I just hung my head to cry. And my best friend Diana looks at me and she goes, look, you were too tall and you had a bad haircut, but it's over now. And it made me laugh, and then we just had a good time the rest of the time. But anyway, back to that. It's hard to shake those old ideas, you know. And in junior high, the kids came up with a nickname for me, and it was, I'm not going to repeat it tonight, but it was based on the size of my lips, which now people pay to have their lips done, so. But none of these things make me an alcoholic, but I think what they did is they got me to drink more quickly. And then, you know, once I was exposed to alcohol, then it set up that phenomenon of craving. And so once I started drinking, it was on from the beginning. There was no line for me to cross. I drank like a pig from the beginning. I never drank socially. You know, it's funny. Sex and the City is my favorite show, and it still is, even though it's in rerun. But, you know, the girls go out, and they drink these beautiful drinks, cosmopolitans or flavored martinis out of these beautiful glasses, and they laugh. And they talk about Mr. Big, and I think, you know, how fabulous that would be, you know, because I've never had any of those drinks. And then I'm quickly reminded that the way I drink is with a funnel and a hose. Like this? Never happened for me. That was not the way I drink. I'm Old English 800. I like 10 high whiskey with a Marlboro Red box back. If I have a choice of a chaser or cigarettes, it's always going to be cigarettes. I drink what you're drinking. And then my mom started bringing me home alcohol when she saw that I was drinking, because my mom cannot resist, you know, like a purchase. If you buy this, you get this free, or if you buy this, you get this half off. So she would come home and say, I brought you home some Meisterbrau. If you buy one case, you get the second case free. It's a terrible beer, but, you know, whatever, it's beer. I remember one night she came home with a bottle of tequila, and if you bought the bottle of tequila, you got two matching shot glasses. I mean, it's like losing money if you don't buy this stuff. So she says, I got you this bottle of tequila for when Ellen comes over on Thursday night for you guys to drink while you watch The Facts of Life. And there's so many things wrong with that sentence, I don't even know. Because there was that sweetness of my friend Ellen would come over on Thursday night so we could watch The Facts of Life, you know, this sweet, wholesome show, but we would usually be drinking, getting ready to go out and drink, because, you know, you have to drink first in case there's not enough, and, you know, so you feel comfortable and all that. I had my first suicide attempt at the age of 12. Like I said, I hated myself. I had another one at 13, and at 13 also, I ended up pregnant, and I terminated that pregnancy at the urging of my mom and my boyfriend, and I drank over that for a long, long time. And it wasn't until I came to the room of Alcoholics Anonymous that I had any peace around that. You know, our book says we won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And that's been my experience. Even now with 24 years, things stay in a place of regret until I can use that experience to help someone else or to change something I'm going through. But back then I was just collecting regret. Like my friend Charlie C. talks about, you know, you're going through your drinking life, driving this big station wagon, and you're just throwing all your regret, I'll deal with that later, remorse, bills, whatever in the back seat, and you're just like, woo, going through life. But then when you get sober, it's as if you throw on the brakes and now, all that stuff is here. But that's what the steps help you sort through. But back then I'm just collecting all that crap. I identify as an alcoholic. I believe my alcoholism gets me wherever I'm weak. That can be food, sex, money, drugs, whatever. My alcoholism is always looking for a way out. And for me, at 13, I started starving myself, and at 17, I started throwing up. So I'd be skinny and perfect because if you loved me, then I would be okay. And I did not get any recovery from that until I addressed my alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's been the way with everything else. If I go to meetings, work with a sponsor, pray, do the steps, work with new people, you know, do all the stuff that I'm taught to do here, all of my other problems seem to resolve. If I address my alcoholism, friendship problems seem to resolve, work problems seem to resolve, finances seem to resolve, health problems not so much, but I'm in a much better spiritual condition to deal with them. But back then I didn't know that, so I was just trying to fill that emptiness because I was so lonely, that bone-chilling loneliness that only an alcoholic can relate to. By the time I get through high school, which is, you know, just barely, by going to summer school, going to continuation, my mom is working, like I said, three jobs, and when she knew I was going to graduate high school, she claimed bankruptcy and moved up to live with her mother, and just, like, checked out. And my relationship with my mom was difficult. I loved her, and I was embarrassed of her. I was ashamed of our house. I remember one time a friend of ours asked if we could house-sit their dog while they were on vacation, and her dad brought the dog over, and he came back 5 minutes later. He said, "I can't leave my dog here. Your house is too dirty." That's what my house looked like. So what I did is I showered twice a day. I feathered my hair like Farrah Fawcett. I washed my chemin-de-fers. I had two pair. I washed them every day, so I had a fresh pair to wear the next day. Again, it was so important that you love me, because if you love me, I'll be okay. My mom was not affectionate with me. She was really smart and funny, and sometimes there were moments where I saw that person that I so wanted her love, but most of the time she was really depressed and angry. And I remember she would, I don't even know why I'm telling this, it's one of those things, I'm doing a little wild card like Mr. Joe C. over there, but so my mom would scream things. So she would come home from work, she'd sit in front of the TV, I would get a lot of, "Not now, Georgie!" She just didn't even want to hear from me. She'd smoke her more menthols, big long ashes all around her chair, just not now. But occasionally I'd be in my room and I'd hear an expletive, "God damn it," run out in the living room. "What, you know, who took my last Diet Coke," or whatever the crazy thing is. And I remember one time I came out and she said, "Where are my orange-handled scissors?" And I said, I don't know. I didn't take your orange-handled scissors." And she said, "To keep anything around here, I have to insert it in my rectum." And I thought, oh, I mean, like, these were crazy things. And my mom, I thought she was crazy. And she would go into these rages about these things. And later, I retold her that story, and she thought it was really funny. Another thing that she told me, because I just knew that there was something wrong with me when I was growing up. I thought maybe I was adopted, and she told me that, and I'm sorry I'm using two cuss words, but she said, a bird shit on a rock and the sun made me grow. And as a kid, you know, I thought that that was pretty bad. And I told her that as an adult, and she just laughed and laughed, thought that was the funniest thing she's ever said. But so my relationship, just to give an example, was quite difficult. I suffer from night fear pretty badly, and what I would do is after she would go to bed, I'd go lay on the floor next to her bed because I wanted to be close to her, and I was afraid, but I'd get up before she got up in the morning. And my mom and grandma were my only family, and I was always told, it's just the three of us. We have to rely on each other. You can't trust anyone else. Everyone will let you down. One day you'll have to work, and it's going to be terrible. You know, my grandma was cleaned rooms at a hotel or motel and was a waitress, and my mom was working in a school cafeteria for half the day. Then she'd clean a person's house the rest of the day, and then she cleaned a church on the weekend. So that was their experience. And where they were concerned, I felt fierce loyalty, embarrassment, shame, blame, love, dependence, all of those feelings at the same time. And when my mom claimed bankruptcy and moved home to my grandma, I was like, cool, because Cuckoo Town is all contained, and they're away, and I can live my life the way I want to. And I continued to drink and drink and drink. And something that got set up for me really early on, too, is my overlapping relationships. And some of you may identify with this, but you know, I've been in relationships since I was 10 years old. I had a 16-year-old boyfriend, which is just so creepy. I don't even, but like I said, at 10 years old, I felt like I was older. I looked like I was older. But when you're in a new relationship, you usually have those wonderful butterflies, and everything just seems better. Every song is your favorite. The sky's never been bluer. The flowers are so pretty. It's so green here. And just everything's better. And then you're in a relationship for a while, and those butterflies start dying down. And in a mature relationship, a long-lasting love replaces those butterflies. But for me, the way I saw it is, you put the butterflies there, and I'm not feeling them anymore. And it must be because you're not doing whatever you were doing to give me those butterflies. And if you loved me, you would. In fact, if you loved me, there's about 10,000 things you'd be doing right now that you're not. So then I would find somebody. I would find somebody to give me the butterflies. And then I would cheat on you. And then you would dump me, and then I would go to the next person as a victim. And I did that over and over and over again. And it was getting pretty exhausting. And so by the end of my drinking, what happened was my mom had moved away. I ended up getting this really great job out of high school, and I started having an affair with my married boss. And so I had to leave that job, and things continued to get worse from there. He wasn't giving me the butterflies anymore. And my roommate had a brother named Danny, and she said, you know, my brother's wife has kicked him out because he has a problem with crack cocaine. He's better now, but she won't forgive him. And he hadn't been to a program or anything. It was just magic. He was just better. And and so she asked if he could come stay with us, and I said, okay. And so he came to stay with us, and the thing I liked most about him is he was crazy about me, and it absolutely didn't matter how I felt about him at all. And so he moved in with us. But the problem was he wasn't done with that crack pipe. And what a surprise. And I don't know about you, but it's hard for me to be with somebody who has a different buzz. You know, when I was a teenager, my friends would be getting stoned. I'd be like, you're so stupid. Give me some. And then I would be stupid, too. Or I go to a kegger party or something, and you see three or four people drift off to the bathroom together, and you're like, well, what, like four people just went in all together. What's going on in there? And then they come out and they're like, I remember my boyfriend going, babe, what? I'm like, I know what you were doing. So, but then they invite you in and then you come out and you're like, ha, you know, so that's kind of what happened with Danny. is he was acting really weird, and I said, I want some. And because I couldn't break up with him. I couldn't. I needed somebody to love me so I'd be okay. And so I started doing that with him, and within 6 months, I lost everything. I got evicted from where I lived. I got fired from my job, and he sold my car for a piece of crack cocaine, which went for about $20 at the time. And I had no place to go, and my best friend Diana and I, who I mentioned earlier, had grown up together, and we partied together, but she grew out of it, moved to San Diego, was living a big life, and I had continued to live near our hometown, just circling the drain. And when I had no place to go, her parents took me in. Her parents had always been kind to me growing up. They sat down and ate dinner together as a family every night. They talked about what the day was like, what their dreams were, what their goals were, you know, just normal kind of family talk. And sometimes I would eat dinner at their house, and I didn't know anything about that. I never sat down to eat dinner at a table like that growing up. So when I was in need, they were the ones who took me in, and I'll be forever grateful to them. And I moved in with Don and Paula, and I'd been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with people who really needed it, because I'm a good friend. But I just knew it wasn't for me. I wasn't raised with any kind of religion, so I didn't believe in God. And the only prayer I ever said is, if you're there, please let me die. And so I just knew that wasn't going to work, and I felt too bad, too good, you know, whatever. I had so many reasons why it wasn't for me, and so I tried to just manage my drinking, which was really, really fun. And I finally one day, after doing that for a while, I quit quitting. As Joe said yesterday, I love that. I quit quitting finally, and I decided if I was going to be miserable, I'd rather be drunk and miserable than sober and miserable. And I poured my first guilt-free drink in the longest time. It was White Zin in the box. And I was drinking that drink, and the phone rang, and it was a guy who worked with Diana, and his name was Jeff M., and he was sober 8 years in the Pacific Group. And he called, and he said, I got your number from Diana. I understand you have a problem with alcohol. And I said, I do. And he said, I want to give you the number of a woman to call in AA. And he gave me the number of Pat Y. And I called Pat, and she said, my husband Vince and I are going to a meeting. Why don't you come with us? And I did. And I get goosebumps every time I share that, because a stranger called me, gave me the number of another stranger who took me to a room full of strangers, and I've been sober ever since. And when I try to articulate what God's grace is, that's it right there. Right there. And because I don't know how anything could ever line up like that for me again, I knew right away that this was something special, you know, and I plan my life around Alcoholics Anonymous, not the other way around. It is my primary purpose. It is the number, it is the focus point of my life. And so I go to the big Wednesday night meeting with Pat and Vince, and it was a lot different than those other meetings I'd been to. Now, it could have been my perception, but it seemed different. And it seemed like there were people who were happy and sober at the same time. And I was like, happy and sober at the same time. How does that happen? And I felt hope for the first time. And Pat said she'd be my sponsor until I found one. And so I started, you know, on this journey with her. And she gave me some really simple direction at the beginning. Go to regular meetings on regular days. And get commitments at those meetings. It was very simple, but I had never had any structure in my life at all. Like I said, I never went to school on a regular basis, to work on a regular basis, didn't sit down to dinner on a regular basis. And so I always thought structure was, you know, like the man trying to keep you down, people over 30 who don't understand what freedom is. And but what I've come to find out is that the more structure I have in my life, the more creative I am, the more free I am, the more time seems to bend, the calmer my heart and soul is, the more peace I have, the more structure. It's so contrary, like so many other things in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I start, you know, going to meetings, terrified, of course, you know, like I wasn't going to go to the second meeting because I didn't know where I was going to park my car. I mean, I came up with all these reasons, and I talked to a normie friend of mine. I said, I don't think I can go, because I don't know where to park. And he said, I mean, just really, you know, I'm not a dumb person, but some things, you know, I just really struggle with. And he said, I'm sure that if they have a meeting there, that they've thought about parking and that there'll be a place for your car. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll go. I mean, it sounds crazy now, but it was so, that fear was so real. So I was about 2 weeks sober. I'm going to meetings now. I'm getting commitments at my meetings. And a family friend came forward and told me all these secrets that my mom and grandma had kept from me. And I always knew that there was something strange about my mom and grandma. They were both really depressed. They seemed to have a lot of secrets between them. They seemed to need to be together all the time, but they hurt each other. You know, one would say something and then the other would, you know, and there'd be silent scoring the rest of the day and lots of, you know, sighing all day and all this weird energy between them. And so his family friend came forward and told me all these secrets, and I was like, I knew it. And so I wrote down all these secrets in a book, and I wanted to be sure that I got every bit of information, because when you screw me over, I like to be really detailed when I throw it in your face. And so I write everything, and what, and then what, And but instead of taking it to my mom like I normally would, I took it to Pat. And she said, it's so good that you have that written down, because you're going to need it later. You know, let me just say this about that. When people say, you know, I'm working on my inventory, it's just so hard, you know, I've really got to do it, it's going to take months, blah, blah, blah. Okay, you've been working on your inventory your whole life. You just need to download. It's all that stuff up there, just download. That's it. It's not that hard. But anyway, so I go to Pat, and she says, I think that you should work on being a good daughter and granddaughter. I'm like, I don't understand. But by that time, I had made a decision. I kept hearing about getting a first-year foundation and how important that first-year foundation is. And so I had made a decision that I was going to do everything that I was asked to do for that first year. And then when it didn't work, I could go back to my glamorous life. And luckily, I've never had to do that. But so I don't know how to be a good daughter and granddaughter. So we came up with a formula, and that was that I'd call once a week, I'd write once a week, and I'd visit as often as I could. If I were doing these things, I would know at the end of the day when my head hit the pillow that I'd been a good daughter. And this was not for them. This was so maybe, just maybe, I could stay sober. Because like I said, where they were concerned, I had so much pain and angst and love and all at the same time. So I started sending a weekly card. I did not tell them I was going to do it. I was constantly telling people what I was going to do tomorrow. And I learned that I had to stop doing that because I couldn't keep my word ever. So I started sending the cards once a week, and I'd call once a week. And I would get a card that already said something to write, Love, Georgia. And so that was enough for a while. And then I would make the weekly call, and I'd have to have a topic because the phone calls were so uncomfortable. And I used to only call when I was in trouble. So every time the phone rang, they'd say, oh, my God, we thought you were dead. Be like, no, you know. So I'd have to have something to kind of ease into a conversation. And so I started getting in the habit of doing that. And eventually I picked up the pace with my cards because I heard about how you guys were doing that. You were making amends to your family and you're writing these beautiful letters. And so I started sharing with them the adventures in my sobriety. And then I got a bit grandiose and I started thinking about how they must be savoring each one of these cards, maybe in a beautiful decorative box, or maybe they were tying them with a beautiful ribbon. And maybe untying them during a cold winter's night and rereading my cards. And thinking, oh, that Georgie. Oh, remember this one. And that's not what was happening, as it turns out. What was happening was I called my mom, and I said, hey, Mom, just calling to check in. And she said, well, we got your card, but Grandma's been having to white them out to reuse them, and we're wondering if you could start writing them in pencil. And I did, and I want to tell you why I did. I did because I now had a sponsor who told me that I'd never have to go through anything ever alone. And I had this incredible fellowship. I never dreamed I would have friends like this. I was starting to have an experience of a higher power as the result of going through the steps with a sponsor. And I had all these tools that I didn't even know existed. I was packing a hefty tool belt. And it may not be fair, but he with the most tools has the most responsibility. And in this case, it was me. And so I wrote those damned cards in pencil. And I wrote a little bit less for a while to punish them, which they didn't notice. which is all good. And just got busy in AA, going through the steps. You know, I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew my life was unmanageable. The God stuff was hard, but I had a sponsor who said, do you believe that I believe? And I said, I do. And I actually felt really sorry for her, that she had to believe in something beyond this world to make this world tolerable for her. I was like, yeah, I believe you believe. It's okay, you know. but she said, I want you to pray to my God. And so that's what I did. And she said, I want you to start keeping a book of coincidences, which she didn't say coincidences. She called them God shots, which made me go, ooh. So we called them coincidences. And by doing that, I started keeping just a log of all these incredible things that were happening. And I don't know when it went from me praying to her God to me praying to my own. But like so many other things in AA, I get busy with the action, and sometimes I don't even realize when the thing changes. It's like I'm talking to somebody, and I say, oh, I used to feel that way. And I'm like, used to? When did I stop? You know, I don't even know. The feelings follow the actions, and that's what I started to learn. So busy doing all of that. Make it to my first year, which is a damned miracle, and in our group, we have a watch. So everybody gathers the night before you're going to turn one at a coffee shop after whatever the meeting is. And I had been told for my first year that all the time and energy I'd want to put into a relationship, put that into getting your first year, into your program. Get a little job to go to in between meetings. All the time and energy you'd want to put into going into school, put that into getting your steps done. No, don't quit smoking, no major changes, and no relationships. And so I'd kept that. So now it's the night of my watch. And after everybody sings happy birthday at midnight, they come by and shake your hand. And there were like 200 people at my watch. And I knew everybody's name except one. And how much my life had changed in just 1 year was magnificent. And so I kept that direction to stay out of a relationship for a year and about an hour and a half. And at about 1:30 a.m., I consummated a relationship with my new fella. And we got engaged 10 days later. And we got married 6 months later. We got divorced 5 years later. I laugh about this, but I mean, he's a wonderful man, and we're both still in the same home group. And the reason why we're both still in the same home group and we're both still sober is because we always put AA first. We were always honest with our sponsors. We were always honest with each other, you know, and so we were able to survive that. But after we split up, you know, it hurt. And I thought I should go to some different meetings just for a while, you know. It hurts. And luckily, I've always had sponsors who have given me good direction. And I was told that I walk through the choices of my life with grace and dignity, and that I show up to my regular meetings on my regular days, and that I'm neither to seek him out or to avoid him. And if I do run into him, I'm not to ask questions like, how you doing? Are you sleeping okay? Are you eating okay? How you doing? Oh, yeah. Not to do that, but instead statements, to say something like, it's good to see you. Have a great meeting. And because I got sober at 24 and I've been in the same home group for 24 years, I have said, it's good to see you. Have a great meeting. A great many times. Oh, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But so by that time, Marilyn S. was my sponsor, and I want to talk a little bit about this. So I've had four sponsors in my sobriety. I had Pat Y., Tracy J., Marion W., and then Marilyn's been my sponsor since I was 2 years sober. And I have never been given bad direction by a sponsor. I've always had just the people I need in my life just at the right times. Today I know if I'm with the right sponsor by answering two questions. So I like to share that because I found it really helpful, so maybe it'll help you too. If I can answer enthusiastically yes to these two questions, I'm with the right sponsor. One, do I want what they have? And two, do I trust their judgment? And if I can answer yes to those two questions, then I don't need to debate anything. I can call her, get direction, take it. I don't have to think, is this crazy? Is this right? I don't know. I just have to be able to answer yes to those two questions. And I've been able to do that now for 22 years with Marilyn. So Mark and I split up when I was around 5 years sober, and about that time I had to have a second back surgery. I'd had minor back surgery early in sobriety, and this was a spinal fusion. And so this was different. I was going to have a recovery time of about 6 months if all went well. And I happened to be one of those people in the 1% where things don't go well, and I ended up being bedridden for about a year. And I was diagnosed with something called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, which is it can be a result of any trauma or injury. And so in this case, they thought the trauma was the back surgery. And what happened for me is my legs swelled up. It turned bright red. I couldn't even have the weight of a sheet touch my skin. It hurt so bad. And so they thought I had a blood clot. And I went to the hospital immediately, and I had all these tests. And the doctor that I was seeing had somebody before me who he had treated for about a year, who he wasn't able to diagnose for almost a year. So when I came in, he knew exactly what I had, and the key is to get into treatment quickly. Otherwise, you end up with amputations or you can end up paralyzed. And so I started seeing this specialist, and I was going to the hospital 3 times a week for treatment. I was getting cervical and lumbar punctures. I was getting nerve blocks and freezing of nerves and all these kind of crazy, it seems so barbaric, and recovering from a spinal fusion where they went in the front. So I have that going on and this, and it was my AA group that took care of me. They took me to my appointments. They brought me meetings. I had to have babysitters every night to help me eat, dress, everything. And I had people taking care of me that I honestly wouldn't have had a cup of coffee with. And I look at these seemingly difficult times of my life, and they turned out to be some of the greatest times of my life, where I've connected with people at that level that I so desperately wanted my whole life. And I had come to learn that emptiness that I was constantly trying to fill, the only way to fill it is to give. Getting is good, but it will never fill that emptiness. And so what that left me with was feeling really useless, because I'd learned to now fill myself up by giving, and now I'm in a place where I'm just of need. I'm just a need monster. And and I felt completely useless and full of self-pity. And, you know, I can pray for a character defect to be removed or for the opposite. And what happens is an assignment appears. And, you know, I was so just really struggling with having to ask for help. But what I learned was that was a way to be of service, to let people help me, because I had done that with other people who had surgeries and taking meetings to their house, and I knew how that filled me up, and so I was able to do that. And I forgot to mention that as soon as Mark and I split up, I got involved with someone else right away. Surprise! But so we were together during this time, and, you know, I was really sick, and I was a few months into this, and by that time I had lost my job because I couldn't work. I couldn't drive, and I couldn't afford my car anymore, so I lost my car. I was just losing one thing after another, and then this guy came to me, and he said that he'd consider a relationship and a commitment with me when I was well, and he dumped me. And I was devastated, and I called my sweet and understanding sponsor, who was learning to play guitar at the time, so oftentimes I'd call her, and she'd be plucking away in the background. And I said, you know, every installation of my pain, I've called her, you know, the surgery, complications, job, car, losing everything. Useless, help me. And so now I call her and I'm like, and now I got dumped. And she said, oh, this sounds like a wonderful country western song. And she started playing a country chord progression and sang my blues. And it made me laugh, which has been one of the greatest gifts of my sobriety, is finding humor in everything. And I am blessed to have a sponsor who finds my most difficult times very humorous. And so I referred to an assignment appearing, and the assignment came in the shape and form of Mike Finch, who Joe talked about Thursday night. Mike was 33-year-old man at that time who I had met in Alcoholics Anonymous, who had Lou Gehrig's disease. And I watched him going from walking and talking to being paralyzed from the neck down and in a wheelchair. The one thing that I never saw change in Mike, though, was his joy for this program. And he used to say, there's no cure for ALS, only AA. And And so he sponsored tons of guys. And as he was living in Vegas, driving up to the big Wednesday Pacific Group meeting, then he moved to San Diego and was driving up, and he'd fill up his handicap van with all these guys he sponsored and was just full of love and just loved AA and funny guy. And that was an attraction to me. And his wife had also left him when he was sick. And so we had that in common, and we started talking, and we became friends, and then we became more than friends. And I was able to spend the last 6 months of his life with him. And I wouldn't have chosen to love somebody that I knew was going to die, but we never know. We never know how much time we have. And, you know, so that's where I met Joe and a lot of the folks in San Diego who I still have relationships with. So Mike and I started this relationship, and he would say that he felt like I was an angel put into his life, but I felt it was the other way around. And so I moved to San Diego with him. So I had made it through the first few months of all these treatments, and just in case I forget to wrap this up later, I still suffer with chronic pain today. And if you suffer from chronic pain, you know, we're not supposed to say our case is different, but I just want you to know our case is different, but maybe not in the way you're thinking that I'm going to say, and that is that I have to do twice as much to feel half as good. And that means I have to do more AA. And the way I treat my pain today is with Pilates and with AA. And I'm sure lots of people have other suggestions, but I'm really good. Thank you so much anyway. But back then I was still really suffering and I still needed care. And so I moved down to be with Mike, and we kind of took care of each other. And his house was filled with people taking care of him. And, you know, we learn in AA that when we're in a situation, try and make it better, you know, take on a commitment. And I had been reading about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and death and dying since, you know, my dad had died when I was young, and I had had friends die. And it wasn't that I was obsessed with death, but I just didn't understand it. And so I had been reading her, and she had talked about photojournaling. And so I made that my commitment. I asked Mike if I could do that. And he let me photograph the last 6 months of his life, like everything. Trips back and forth to the hospital, people coming to visit, barbecues. My favorite picture, I was telling Joe, I can't really show a lot of people, but so Mike needed help doing everything, and I would help him with most things, but this, I was not a lifter because I was, you know, recovering from this back surgery, so one of the guys would have to get him on the commode. And so the picture is, he's on the commode. One of his sponsees is sitting on the bathtub across from him, just going, "Well, me, me, me," while Mike's trying to have a moment. And another one of his sponsees is sitting on the sink, completely oblivious, playing guitar. And that picture encompasses that time so beautifully. I used to call Mike the Make-A-Wish Boy, which is really not tasteful at all, I know, but he had a really good sense of humor, and he was living his life to the fullest, you know, and people would say, "Oh, you're with Mike? Isn't he dying?" You know, people say the craziest things. Just know that. Just say thank you and keep moving. But I would say, no, he's not. He's living in a really big way, and he was, you know, and I that was an attraction to me, and there came a point where he needed to get a feeding tube, and he couldn't eat anymore. And I had had this situation when I was little. My dad had stomach cancer. And they had done all these surgeries, and they'd kind of run out of stuff to do, so they did what they called a guinea pig operation, and they had left this big hole in his stomach. And he would be in a reclining chair, and you know, stuff would bubble out and burn his skin, and my mom used to have to put a tube in there and put stuff in there. And I was daddy's little girl. I loved my dad. Mom who, you know, I loved my dad. And so one day I asked to help, and I was holding onto that tube, and I let go, and it sprayed everywhere. And it was like one of those memories that plagued me. I would be walking down the street and it would be like, ah, you know, the memory would just pop into my head. And I had no idea that Alcoholics Anonymous could help me with that. I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was just about not drinking. So flash forward, I'm with Mike. He gets the feeding tube, and he says, "I want Georgia to feed me." And I'm like, "Ha, ha, 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 no." I go, no. I said, "You have to tell me if it sprays everywhere, that'll be okay." And he said, "No, that would be really bad." But then I told him about what had happened with my dad, and he said, "Well, let's just try." You know, so I did it, and, you know, of course, I became the number one feeder and medicine giver. "No, I've got this." And But there's so many things like that I just didn't think could be resolved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Mike was so kind with me. It was such a time filled with, there was so much sadness, but there was so much joy. And it was so fun and scary, terrifying, all of those things. And I got to feel it all. And I think as an alcoholic, I'm so terrified of my feelings, you know, and I miss so many things because I was so afraid of my feelings. But I got to experience this. I got to experience it all. I got to feel every bit of it. And I think of my friend Julie, who's a member of my home group, and her son died on his senior trip about 15 years ago, suddenly in a car accident. And she was so, so, so sad. And people were suggesting that she get help. And, you know, you've been sad a really long time. And she did. She said, no, I want to feel every feeling that has to do with this glorious boy. I don't want to miss a feeling that has to do with him. And I thought about that. Like, I have missed so much. I don't want to miss any more moments. And I don't have to. So the house was filled with people like Joe, who I love and adore. Have I said that enough times now? Are we good? And when Mike died, I was there. His dad was holding one of his hands, and I was holding the other. And it doesn't always happen that way, but in this case, it did. And I feel really blessed to have been there. About a month before Mike died, my grandma passed away. Now, I do have to say that through the years, I kept up with those cards and pencil and the weekly calls. And let me say this, that my mom and grandma never believed that they should have to call me. They only thought I should have to call them. And this is a real phone call. I called and they said, well, we wanted to wish you a happy birthday, but you didn't call. And so I learned on my birthday that I could spend the whole day saying, I know they're not going to call. I know they're not going to call. And then at the end of the day say, I knew it. Or I could wake up on my birthday and call them and say, today's my birthday and I just want to tell you I love you and enjoy the rest of the day. What? Like, these are crazy ideas. And I'll get back on track, but along those same crazy idea lines, I remember when Sharon C., who was B at the time, shared about hearing a sad song on the radio and changing the station. Okay, never occurred to me. I hear a sad song on the radio and I lean in, I'm like, and even if a happy song follows now, I'm going to switch and find another sad song. Might look in the rearview mirror. Never occurred to me to change the station. And I'm not a dumb person, but these, like, I learned a lot of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. But by the time my grandma had died, she had become this really sweet grandma. She was not that when I was growing up. She used to tell me I ruined my mom's life, that if my dad were alive, he'd be disappointed in me. She would tell me my hair was stringy, and she would tell me how ugly I was. And she was not a nice grandma. Somehow she changed over the years. And I think it's as we see our disease ripple out into the lives of the people we love, so do we see our recovery. I don't know, but I wanted them to see the new me, and my grandma turned out to be this really nice grandma. And I had been able to be a good granddaughter to her. So when she died, we were clean. And I was able to be there for my mom. So then Mike passed away, and I moved back to Los Angeles trying to get my life back together. I hadn't worked in a long time, and I was still having a lot of chronic pain, and I wasn't willing to do the stuff I was willing to do when I was new, that stuff that tapped me into joy. You know, because now it's different. I've got some time. That's not the solution. This is much bigger. And so I was suffering, and I called my mom to check in. By that time, I'd got a place to live, a little job, a little car, was trying to get back into the flow of life, and my mom said she needed to see me, and so I drove up to see her. And I had never found it necessary to throw those secrets that I'd written down when I was 2 weeks sober in her face. And so now, many years later, she sat down with me and said, there's some things I need to tell you now that Grandma's gone. And she was keeping these secrets out of respect for her mother because they involved her. And so she told me her life story. Now, the secrets that I had learned was that my mom and dad were never married, even though my mom said they were and had an anniversary that I wished her happy anniversary every year. that my mom had embezzled the money that my dad left me. And I used to think, well, my dad left me money. He didn't leave it to you and it's mine. But she used it to raise me. You know, it's all kind of perception stuff. And that my dad was an alcoholic, that my dad was a womanizer. These are the secrets that I had found out. But what came to happen was I spent these 2 days with my mom, and my mom told me her story. And that was that at the age of 8, my grandma was sent to live with another family because her family couldn't take care of my grandma and her sister. So they sent my grandma to live with another family. And in that house, she was the house girl. She cooked and cleaned and was physically and sexually abused by the men in that family. And the way that she got out of that is she got pregnant by a man she didn't love with my mom, got married, and left that situation. And before my mom was even born, she had already divorced that man and had gone about her life. So my mom was raised being left at boarding schools, being left with other families, just like had happened to my grandma. My mom did that. My grandma did that with my mom. And eventually, my mom ended up living with her dad and her stepmom, and my grandma would come to visit, and she'd be in these shiny cars and have furs and jewels. And one day, my mom was given the choice, you go with her today, or you never see her again, basically. And so my mom, you know, of course, like many of us, you know, go for the shiny objects. And so she went off with her mother, and it turned out that my grandma had turned to a life of racketeering and prostitution. And she turned my mom out to work that business when my mom was 15. So my grandma never went to another school, another day of school after she was 8 years old. And with my mom, it was 15. And my mom told me her story, and I since have not heard a worse story inside or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous is the story my mom told me about her growing up and the many abuses that she endured from the men coming in and out of that house, from my grandma accusing her of, you know, seducing her boyfriends. And my mom was pregnant at 15 and pregnant at 16 and put both of those babies up for adoption. And while she was pregnant with those children, she lived on the streets of Hollywood, sleeping in doorways and, you know, depending on the kindness of strangers. And the church that she had so loved, that the boarding school she had gone to had turned their back on her because now she was this, you know, failed woman. And so there was no friendly direction for her. Every person she ever loved had abused her. And I could not even imagine that that was my mom's life. I never even dreamed that I would hear that coming out of her mouth. And my mom and dad were not married. She told me that. She said that she was my dad's mistress. And when my dad died, his money went to his wife. And how painful that must have been for her, and how shameful. And you know, my dad had had affairs, and my dad had had an affair with a neighbor and raised that child. The neighbors were raising that child as their own and didn't even know. I mean, it was just like 2 days of this. It was like listening to somebody's really long fist step. But what a blessing. And the reason that she was able to talk to me about this stuff that she hadn't talked about in over 30 years was because I'd been making those weekly calls. I'd been sending those weekly cards and had built that trust through consistent behavior on my side of the street. And that was the most valuable lesson I think I've learned so far in sobriety, is I am only responsible for my side of the street. What you do on your side of the street, none of my business. In fact, the dirtier your side of the street is, the cleaner mine needs to be. The only access to power I have is on my side of the street. It's over here. It's not over there. I've fiddled about over on your side of the street several times looking for power. It's not there. So my mom's telling me this horrific story about her life, and I'm just sitting there, and I'm so glad I didn't hear it when I was newer, because it would have been all about me. And in this case, it wasn't. I got to say, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry that happened to you. And I don't think she expected that, and I don't think she'd ever heard anybody say that. And I began to have this mad crush on my mom. I was so grateful I'd been given that direction to treat my mom like she was this amazing mom, to send the cards, to make the calls, to do the visits, to do all the stuff. Because as it turns out, my mom was like a superhero. The fact that she was able to keep me in the same house until I graduated from high school, the fact that she was there every day, the fact that I didn't endure the life that she and my grandma had. I had the life of a princess compared to the life that they had. And I just thought, wow, you know, my whole life, I was so angry with her for not giving me what I needed. If she'd been a better parent, if she'd put me in music classes or dance, or she had taught me to go, you know, told me to go to college, if I had a better parenting, if I had been loved at home, I wouldn't have been looking for it everywhere else, and, you know, all of these things. this love and guidance I was so mad she didn't give me were things she never possessed. So I'm mad at her for not giving me something she did not have in her possession. That's insanity. And I learned that from this program, and I had learned to take my mommy stuff to my sponsor and to my girlfriend, so I got to just get to know Betty. And Betty was remarkable. She was so, so smart. She knew every answer on Jeopardy. And I could call her about anything. She knew just a little bit about everything. She worked crossword puzzles like crazy. She was so, so smart. But where I turned to drugs and alcohol, she turned to hoarding. And her house was like those shows. And so when I would go to visit her, not only was it on me to go visit, but I also would have to save my pennies because I couldn't stay in her house. I'd have to get a little motel room in town. And you have to walk sideways through her house. And at one point, you know, when I was sober a while longer and, you know, knew better, I thought that I would report her and, you know, get that all fixed up over there. And luckily, my sponsor suggested that I just love her exactly as where she is. And I can offer to help where I can, but, you know, just to love her where she was. And that's what I did. And I was able to have this wonderful relationship with my mom. And I just loved her. What happened after that is I got, like I said, I was back in my home group trying to get my life back together, but not willing to do all the stuff I was willing to do. And I had a resentment against my home group. And I was depressed and I was in pain. And I thought, this is the perfect time to choose a life mate. And and I got married again. Not his fault. He never pretended to be anything that he wasn't. He's a very lovely person, but we should not have been on a second date. And but we did. We got married, and it was Mike's dad who walked me down the aisle. And you know, it's Mike's parents, back to that just for a moment, after Mike died, they poured so much love on me. They would always say how grateful they were to me. And they even had an ode to me on his tombstone. And I just felt so unworthy. I'd only been with him 6 months. He had been married before, you know, and he and his wife were super active in AA. But when he was diagnosed, she ended up going back out. And she was out for a really long time. And I just didn't feel worthy of all the love and appreciation they gave me. And then it wasn't until a few years ago on Facebook, of all places, it was the anniversary of Mike's death, and his mom was writing about how Mike had made the decision. So he's 34 years old, and now, you know, having to make that decision. When you die of ALS, your muscles stop working, and you suffocate, basically. And so he'd made the decision that when it came to that point, he didn't want any extraordinary measures. He just wanted to be put into a drug-induced coma and go night-nights. And no feeding tube, none of that. So he had the family meeting, and then he and I hooked up at the Mountain High Conference in Lake Arrowhead. And then he came home and he called the family meeting, and he said, I want the feeding tube. So they felt like he'd been given those extra 6 months. So his dad walks me down the aisle. Woo! Came back. That was really close, though. Trying to get active in my group again, just feeling so sorry for myself, making excuses why I can't go to meetings because I'm in pain. And my sponsor would say things like, well, when you stay home, are you in pain? And I would say, mm-hmm. And she would say, well, then why don't you come to the meeting and be in pain? And I would say, oh, you don't understand. But she was right, that if I could take care of my spiritual condition, why wouldn't I do that? And so what happened for me is I ended up in a suicidal depression. I had one last right before I got sober. So I'd had three suicide attempts while I was drinking, and now I was contemplating that with double-digit sobriety. I don't even know how I got there, but I had backed off of meetings. I, like I said, had a resentment against my home group. I married somebody that I shouldn't have been on a second date with, not his fault. And then my mom got really sick, and she got lung cancer, and then it went to bone cancer, and then it went to her brain. And I went and spent the last 3 months of her life with her, helping to take care of her. Well, helping. She had nobody in her life. There was nobody after my dad died. She never dated again. She never had any friends. It was just me. And I took care of her those last 3 months. And I was really in a bad, bad place. And I remember exactly where I was standing when I realized that I couldn't kill myself because I believe if you do, you have to come back and repeat all the lessons from this life. And I'm like, no way, I'm halfway done. I am not doing this again. And I couldn't drink, and how do I best want to pass the rest of this wretched time on earth? And so, being a keen-minded alcoholic, I thought, well, maybe I'll go through the steps again. I don't know, maybe it'll work. And so I went through the steps again with my sponsor. I beefed up my program, and it's funny, as I did show up at meetings in pain, I started to feel better. Part of my third step practice is I say yes to whatever I'm asked to do. I feel like that's God keeping my calendar. If I'm asked to do something, I open my calendar. If it's open, I say yes. And that's not just AA related. That's in any category. I feel like that's God keeping my calendar. And as a result, I just was saying yes to everything. And so I was staying busy even though I didn't want to get out of bed, because left to my own devices, I want to lay in bed and watch reruns of Law and Order. And that's what I would do every day if I didn't have a full calendar. But my mom passed away, and I do want to tell this story just about her really quickly. I had been taking care of her those last few months, and we went to the hospital. She was 75 years old, sick as a dog, and she had to have yet another x-ray or test of some sort, and the x-ray technician came out. And she looked right at him, and she said, "This won't affect my ability to bear children, will it?" It was so funny, you know, and I would have missed it all if I followed the well-meaning suggestions of people in AA who talked about confronting and, you know, having boundaries and not keeping secrets and all of that, when in AA I was taught about love and tolerance. And so that's happened now. I'm in this situation where I'm now trying to beef up my program, saying yes to the universe, and I finally, as a result of that really dark time, became complete. I had always been looking for somebody to complete me. It's such a romantic notion. You complete me. Ugh. You know, it's so good. But what that means is without you, I'm incomplete, which now leaves you responsible for my happiness. And you're not going to be able to keep me happy, and I'm going to have to overlap you. And so... So as a result of this really dark time, I ended up... going through another divorce and, you know, really beefing up my program. I ended up working for the Midnight Mission. I'd been volunteering there since I was brand new, and I had always felt the pull to be there. It's a Skid Row mission where we help homeless people restore them to sanity. Yes, restore self-sufficiency too. And so I had gotten a job there, and I was really active again in AA, and I was feeling so good and so whole and didn't need a man. Finally, amen. A man is not a plan, ladies. And what happened was I fell in love. I did everything differently this time. I didn't get the U-Haul on the second date, you know. He wasn't in AA, and we got to get to know each other, and it was slow going, and it was like a date a week for a while. I'm like, oh, you know, but I was different in this relationship because I wasn't looking for him to complete me. I was going to AA. I was going to my higher power to fill that stuff, and this relationship enhanced my life, and vice versa, I thought. And it was such a sweet relationship that I almost couldn't even tell people, because we were so sweet. So we were together about 3.5 years when we moved in together and got engaged. And he worked for a radio station and didn't have to get up early, but he got up early every morning and made me coffee. And while I was getting ready for work, he would make me lunch. And on every one of my little lunch bags, he would write a sweet little note, and he'd pack my lunch, and he'd walk me to the car when I went to work. And then we'd call and text throughout the day, "Love you," and we have cute little names, which I'm not even going to repeat. But and then at night we'd have dinner together, and then we'd go to bed holding hands, and maybe we'd listen to music or we'd read something. We loved David Sedaris. We'd read David Sedaris and laugh. And I would do stuff with him at the station, and he would help me out at the Midnight Mission. He would MC these events for me, and our life was big and beautiful and full. And I mean, going to the supermarket was fun, and I had never had love like that in my whole life. and we were together 7 years, and so a few years ago, I had this nagging feeling in my gut that something wasn't right, and everyone was telling me, you're trying to sabotage the best thing that's ever happened to you, you don't have any proof, you know, you're crazy, basically, except they didn't say that, except for Nancy. Nancy was the only one who was like, yeah, but I didn't, and so finally what happened was I couldn't stand the feeling in my gut, and I checked something. I checked his phone, and I found out that he had a whole secret life, and that he'd had it since we were first together, and that there were not one, not two, but dozens of others. And I was completely heartbroken. But everything I do at the Midnight Mission and everything I do in AA is based on the idea that people can change. And I see it every day. I see people who are homeless who are now thriving. I see people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous who I thought, she's never going to stay, who now have 10, 15, 20 years, whatever. And so I needed to bring that home. And so I did. And I was able to do that, I think, because it wasn't personal. And I knew it wasn't personal. Now, it hurt like hell. But I knew it wasn't about me. And so I stayed close to my sponsor. I stayed close to my friends. I really worked harder on my program. And I stayed and tried to work it out, but this was not a situation that was going to resolve. And I prayed for clarity, and one day I got it, and I knew that I had to walk away. And so I did that in March. In March we broke up, and then he moved out in May. 2 months. It was a little rough. But he moved out while I was speaking at a meeting out of state, actually. I couldn't have been in a better place. And I share this with you, because something like this would have broken me before. It always broke me. I was always starting over, even in AA. It always broke me. And I'm not broken. I'm brokenhearted. And there's a difference, and that's an appropriate emotion. That is an appropriate emotion for what I'm going through. Not so appropriate, the bursting into tears at awkward moments, but I'm getting through that too. And I have a lot of loving people in my life. And, you know, next to getting sober, the greatest thing that's happened to me is working at the Midnight Mission. You know, I have found beyond Alcoholics Anonymous even more depth in my meaning and purpose in life. And in working there, too, I have found something else. So I have, music has always been really cathartic to me. I love to sing, really cathartic for me. Not so much for my audiences, as it turns out. And so I thought, how cruel is it that God would give me this desire and this passion and then have me suck at it? And really, I mean, this was a serious thing. I was really disturbed by this, because that's like, what do you want to do? That's what, it's music, it's music. Ah, I'm possessed by music. And how cruel to not give me the chops. And then I go to work at the Midnight Mission, and I realized that maybe God gave me that passion, not for me to shine, but for him to shine through me. And I created a music program, and I bring musicians to play for our homeless community. And it started out being once a month, and now it's like every week. And I've had people from AA who play music. In fact, Bob Darrell's going to be there next Thursday, to big bands. And we have a street symphony that comes in, which is a group from the LA Phil. And so I'm involved in music all the time, and it's running through me. And we do open mics, and of course I perform at each and every one. But but if there's something that you feel passionate about, if there's a desire in you and you're thinking, why isn't this working? Maybe it's for you to use to help someone else. Maybe it's not, you know, for what you necessarily you think. I just want to thank all of you. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that's happened in my life. And this has been one of the best conferences I've ever been to. You guys have been so lovely. Thanks for having me in Nashville.